I'm John.
And I'm Ash.
And this is Your Damn Right Award Podcast. We're going, not only should we win awards, this is a podcast where we're going to give awards. in case you were confused, I'm fine with that distinction. So we're going to talk about 2015. Everything eligible, every actor, television show or episode that will be discussed in the context of 2015. So what you did in 2014 or what you're doing in 2016 does not matter. That's the cutoff date, January 1st until today. So you ready to get started, Ash?
Yeah.
All right, so we're going to start with Best Supporting Actress. We have 5 nominees. I'm going to tell you who these nominees are, why they are the nominees, what characters they played. Then Ash is going to tell you who her winner is, and I'm going to tell you mine. Best Supporting Actress for You're Damn Right. Regina King, American Crime, as Aaliyah Shadid, an accused murderer's sister and a convert to Islam. For her portrayal, King has won an Emmy and is currently nominated for a Golden Globe and a Satellite Award. Carrie Bechet, Halt and Catch Fire, as Donna Clark, a conflicted wife, competent CEO, and overwhelmed mother. To my knowledge, Bechet has yet to be nominated for any major awards other than this current Your Damn Right Award, which I am sure she is flattered. Carrie Coon, The Leftovers, as Nora Durst, a wife and mother who lost her husband, son, and daughter in the sudden departure. For her portrayal, Coon has been nominated for 2 consecutive Critics' Choice Awards. Regina King, again, The Leftovers, as Erica Murphy, a doctor who runs an urgent care facility and has to cope with the disappearance of her daughter. For her portrayal, King is currently nominated for a Critics' Choice Award. And finally, Elizabeth Moss, for Mad Men, as Peggy Olson, a former secretary who has risen to the ranks of executive advertiser at a prestigious firm. For her portrayal, Moss was nominated for 4 Emmys, 3 Screen Actors Guild Awards, a Satellite Award, and a Golden Globe. In fairness, Moss is often placed as a leading actress, but I'm classifying her as a supporting actress because she's on screen less than most of these other supporting actresses. Okay. So, drum roll. Da-da-da-da. Ash, your winner is?
I'm picking Regina King from The Leftovers.
Not Regina King from American Crime. She didn't do nearly as good. So, tell us why.
Before I didn't see a lot of the other shows, but there was something about the character that Erica, that Regina King played. Sometimes when someone does a portrayal of someone, and as great as they are, it doesn't really, not necessarily, it's not great, but it could be, doesn't necessarily stick. And then that's something, a character I sit there and think about and try to analyze. Something, not just the character itself, but the way, Regina King portrayed this character was a character that, that was constantly in my head. I'm trying to figure this character out, The way she did it, it was, it moved me, and it was also, I gave that feeling of sympathy as well as unsettling, and I think she portrayed that character very, very well.
I think that's well said, and I would, if this was just my awards, I would have also had her nominated, but my winner is Carrie Coon from the very same show. I agree with basically everything everything you said about Regina King. The thing about Carrie Coon that sort of distinguishes her to me to the slightest degree is that Carrie Coon is playing a character that has to carry more of a backstory. Like, throughout every episode,
yeah,
she is the character we know that lost her entire family, and she's trying to form a new family, and she's trying to deal with Kevin's shit, and she's trying to get over this capacity that she is somehow to blame for all of this. And, like, even when the character is doing something as simple as having a conversation with basically her adopted daughter, Jill, or daughter or stepdaughter or whatever their relationship is, like, everything she says and emotion she conveys reminds us of her history and the depth of that character and her facial expressions. And when she has an opportunity to play off of someone else that is on her level, like Regina King, and the showdown we'll talk about later with Erica, with Carrie Coon and Regina King, she can be so powerful, and she can. One of the things the show was able to do very well, The Leftovers, is catch us up on a lot of things without a lot of pure exposition, without characters stopping to go, hey, why is this? Or hey, remember this? And like, one of the reasons it can do that is one of the reasons we never have to be reminded verbally about all the shit Carrie Coon's been through is because she somehow carries it on her persona. And I think the work she does is really pretty marvelous. And if nothing else, I think she was on screen a little more than Regina King. So for me, here you go.
Yeah.
If
she was on a little more, I probably would have nominated for Lee.
See, she's put with supporting actresses, so I'm fine with that. The only lead on The Leftovers that I think is Justin Theroux. Like, he's the...
Yeah.
that motherfucker. Jennifer Aniston's piece. So, best supporting actor. And the nominees are... Jonathan Banks from Better Call Saul. As Mike, a former police officer working independently as a parking lot attendant and later a private investigator and cleaner. For his portrayal, Banks has won a Critics' Choice Award and been nominated for an Emmy and a Satellite Award. Ben Mendelsohn, Bloodline, as Danny Rayburn, the oldest son and black sheep of the family. For his portrayal, Mendelsohn has been nominated for an Emmy, a Golden Globe, and a Critics' Choice Award. Bokeem Woodbine, Fargo. As Mike Milligan, an aspirational philosopher of an executive hitman who works within the corporate Kansas City Mafia. For his portrayal, Woodbine is currently nominated for a Critics' Choice Award. Peter Dinklage, Game of Thrones, as Tyrion Lannister, the ill-respected dwarf of House Lannister. This season, Tyrion meets with Daenerys Targaryen and becomes an advisor to her rule. For his portrayal, Dinklage has won 2 Emmys, a Golden Globe, and a Satellite Award. And Cameron Monaghan. Am I saying that right, Ash? Monaghan?
I guess so.
Shameless, as Ian Gallagher, the third of the Gallagher siblings. At the end of season 4, Ian is diagnosed with bipolar disorder, a mental disorder his mother, Monica, has been diagnosed with. For his portrayal, Monaghan has been nominated for a Critics' Choice Award. And your winner is?
This is a toss-up between Bokeem and Cameron. But I'm going to go with Cameron.
Okay, tell us why.
Yeah, the way his story went, you know, last season, it felt very realistic. And, you know, it's not easy to play, you know, someone with a mental illness, and the way that his story went and the way that he portrayed this character was very moving and was very heart-wrenching. And to see this character, like you've seen from the other season, to see his way his character, you know, decline, and a lot of stuff being brought back up, like him, you know, running off to the military before he was even 18, and just different stuff that he did and his relationship with his boyfriend, and it was very touching and moving, and I really enjoyed the way he did it. He's an amazing actor.
Okay, I had sort of a toss up too between Bokeem Woodbine and Ben Mendelsohn. Ben Mendelsohn was such the driving force of Bloodline. Like, his character was so immensely just squirmy and hateable that it drove all the action on the show, and without him, I don't know if the show's even any good. So, like, he gets very strong consideration for me, but at the end of the day, I gotta go with my man Bokeem Woodbine. Look, the thing Bokeem did is he took a role that could have just been another role. Like, if that role was given to a fat Irishman, like, who cares about Mike Milligan?
Yeah.
But Bokeem He made, first of all, the thing he does with his voice, where it's all sing-songy
Yeah.
sometimes, and it makes, and he will be saying, like, the most, like, subtle, violent innuendos, and, like, he will be threatening people, but it's in such a nice way, and then you just hang on every word, and, like, he can come, he can drive up to, like, a shootout and say, well, okay then, and drive off, and, like, you're like, holy shit, that dude is awesome. And the most impressive thing Woodbine does to me is the way that in just a split second, he is able to completely but believably change a persona. Like when he's having a conversation with a cop or with a Gerhardt, he's able to go from inquisitive and philosophical and questioning and sort of a nice seeming guy, even though there's like, he's clearly communicating like this danger underneath. He seems like a nice enough guy. But then, like, all of a sudden in a minute, he'll just be like, bitch, I will kill you. and there's no doubt that you believe he will kill you. He was just masterful in that role this year. And I really hope we get to see him in more different kinds of roles. Because he has, I think, a lot of range and a lot of different abilities that he showcased in Fargo. All right, so I guess we'll go to actress and actor next. We are saving episode and scene till the end to avoid spoilers. So, like, after we announce our best drama and best comedy, if you don't want a spoiler for a show we're talking about, you can turn off or tune out. Because, like, there's no way to talk about, like, the best scene or episode without talking about what happens in those scenes and episodes. So, best actress. Let me find my sheet. All right. The nominees are Carrie Russell, The Americans, as Elizabeth Jennings, a KGB agent who is an illegal spy posing as a travel agent in the Washington, D.C. area. For her portrayal, Russell has been nominated for 2 Critics' Choice Television Awards for Best Actress, 1 Satellite Award for Best Actress, and 1 Saturn Award for Best Actress. Rachel Bloom in Crazy Ex-Girlfriend as Rebecca Brunch, the titular Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. For her portrayal, Bloom is currently nominated for a Golden Globe and a Critics' Choice Award. Viola Davis, How to Get Away with Murder as Professor Annalise Keating. She is a high-profile defense attorney who teaches a class at Middleton University, and that hardly seems to tell who she is. For her portrayal, Davis has already won an Emmy and a Screen Actors Guild Award. Tatiana Maslany, Orphan Black, as a number of clones, mainly Sarah, Rachel, Allison, Helena, and Cosima, all born in 1984 to various women by in vitro fertilization. For her work, Maslany has won 2 Critics' Choice Awards and a TCA Award. She has also been nominated for an Emmy and a Golden Globe for all for Best Actress in a Drama. Finally, Aya Cash, You're the Worst, as Gretchen Cutler, a cynical and self-destructive music PR executive with clinical depression. For her portrayal, Cash is currently nominated for a Critics' Choice Award. All right, Ash, your winner is...
This one was a big toss-up as well. It was between Viola and Tatiana. And I'll probably get a lot of shit for it. But I'm going to go with Viola Davis.
Oh, my God. I can't believe that just happened. Like, I wish you could have seen my face, my jaw drop.
Like, it was, like, it was down to the last minute, like, right before I said the name. Like,
they're going to kick you out of Orphan Black.
I know. I hope nobody from my group listens to it. Because those don't know, I help run a Facebook group called Orphan Black Clone Club. It's on Facebook.
She's an administrator. Administrator. All right, defend yourself, Ash.
Oh, gosh, I'm scared. I almost would have taken that. But, okay. I love Tatiana, and everything. She does an amazing job. Just This is just flawless work that she does. I think reason why I went Viola, because she, I don't know. It's just something about the way she portrays this character. Like, every scene is just, I'm super focused. If it was probably like last season, you know, I probably would have went with Tatiana. But, you know, I don't know. It's something about, like, I'm so focused on the character, Professor Keating, and what she's doing, what she's saying, how she's going about everything. It's just, I'm hanging on every bit of it. And the way she just manipulates and does her portrayals, I don't know. It's, you know, like I said, I love Tatiana. And I was like, at the last minute, I almost picked her. But at the last minute, I ended up switching it. And even with, you know, Tatiana bringing on, you know, a new character, Crystal, you know, I'm blown away by her portrayals. But something about the way Viola Davis did her work this season, I just been absolutely in tune and focused on, like, every bit of thing that she does, every bit of thing that she says, and the way she comes off. And we've seen, like, the character's ups and downs, and just,
okay. Look, in Ash's defense, this is a tough category. Viola Davis is a force of nature. Aya Cash is doing something amazing where she's playing a comedic part while also portraying very accurately and acutely a case of clinical depression. Rachel Bloom is doing a musical about a crazy ex-girlfriend and making it watchable, so that's awesome. And Carrie Russell is just so nuanced and so, I mean, she plays it part as well as anyone could play it. The winner is Tatiana Maslany. And the winner, it's really simple. It's what she is asked to do on that show so far surpasses what anyone else is asked to do on another show that it's not close. If you replace any of these characters with an average actress, someone who would get a C out of the A plus F range, all of the shows would depreciate. None of them would be as good. But only one of them would fall completely off the map. There would be no Orphan Black without Tatiana Maslany. Not only does she manage to play six or seven different characters in a single episode, she does it in such a way that you don't think, oh, here's Tatiana Maslany being Allison, here she is being Rachel. Like, her voice changes, her laugh changes, her posture changes. It's really fucking incredible. What else is really incredible is sometimes these different clones will play each other. And there's a difference in Tatiana Maslany playing Rachel and Tatiana playing Sarah playing Rachel, or Tatiana playing Sarah playing Cosima, and Tatiana Maslany playing Cosima. Like, there are so many subtle variations of all of these characters that she plays, and so many different things she is asked to do, and that she does extremely, extremely well. And she's the best crier on TV. Like, when Sarah Manning cries, I want to cry. It's because it's fucking heartbreaking.
Cosima cried too, but you don't like Cosima.
I mean, it's still sad because she's such a good crier, but Cosima has it coming, so it's mixed feelings. In all seriousness, though, Ash, you're going to have to get a new group.
That's a lot of people.
I'm posting it everywhere. Ashley Cannon does not love Tatiana Maslany anymore. That's the headline. No, seriously, I understand. Viola Davis is a force of nature. She's great, but for me, everything Maslany does is what would happen if she was replaced by, let's just say, that lady who played the lawyer on Empire. Like, this show would be unfucking watchable. Anyway,
it was a hard decision, though. It was, like, super hard. When I say it was down to, like, right before I said the name, like, it was really hard.
Alright, bet. So, got you guys, if you're listening and you were wondering why Maslany did not win an Emmy, it's because of someone like Ash.
It was weird because around every time I would have picked Tatiana Maslany.
All right. Best actor. The nominees are Bob Odenkirk, Better Call Saul. As James Jimmy McGill, a small-time scam artist who becomes a lawyer, then becomes involved in the criminal world. For his portrayal of Morgan in Better Call Saul, Odenkirk has been nominated for a Screen Actors Guild Award, a Golden Globe, a Satellite, and an Emmy. He has won a Critics' Choice Award. Robbie Malek, Mr. Robot, as Elliot Alderson, a security engineer at AllSafe Cybersecurity and a vigilante hacker. He has social anxiety disorder and deals with clinical depression and delusions, which cause him to struggle socially and live isolated from other people. For his portrayal, Malek is currently nominated for a Critics' Choice Award, a Golden Globe, a Screen Actors Guild Award, a Satellite Award, and inevitably an Emmy. John Hamm, Mad Men, as Don Draper, a hard-drinking, chain-smoking executive with a shadowy past who has achieved success in advertising. For his portrayal, Hamm has won a Golden Globe, 2 Screen Actors Guild Awards, 2 Television Critics Association Awards, and an Emmy following 7 consecutive nominations. Oscar Isaac, Show Me a Hero, as Nick Wasicko, a former police officer, then Yonkers City Council member running for election to be mayor of Yonkers, eventually the youngest big city mayor in the nation. For his portrayal, Isaac is currently nominated for a Critics' Choice Award, a Golden Globe, and a Satellite Award. He will also inevitably be nominated for an Emmy. Andrew Lincoln, The Walking Dead, as a small-town sheriff's deputy who shares a son, Carl Grimes, with wife Lori Grimes. He awakens from a coma to find the world overrun with zombies and a fight for survival ensues. For his portrayal, Lincoln has won a Saturn Award and is nominated for a Critics' Choice Award. Ash, your winner is?
Well, mostly because I haven't gotten around to watching some of these other shows. But I'm picking Andrew Lincoln for his portrayal of Rick Grimes on The Walking Dead. The reason I'm picking him, well, like I said, I didn't get a chance to watch the other shows, but the way he portrays this character season after season, when we get to season 5, and even up to now in the first half of season 6, it shows like the way his mental state has, you know, become so severe, and the way he's declined, and he's trying to get his mind back, and being thrust into having, you know, his whole crew, his whole family, his team, you know, having the weight of their lives on his shoulders, and the fact that he, you know, he's become a man who doesn't take chances anymore, and he has to, you know, being thrust into this life of civilization after being out there in, you know, the fucked up world that it is now with, you know, dead people walking around trying to kill you every day, every, you know, second of the day, and being, you know, in civilization now around normal, quote-unquote, normal people, it showed how, you know, how far this character has become. And the way Andrew Lincoln portrays this character, you know, the way he has these subtle tics about, you know, Rick, you know, the head tilt, or the way he would just stare, or, you know, the way he reacts to certain, you know, characters, like the way he will react to Michonne versus to the way he'll react to a character, Carol and stuff, or Daryl, and it's an amazing thing the way he's able to do it, and it's not an easy role. People think, like, you know, be playing on The Walking Dead would be an easy thing, you know, you're just fighting those zombies. No, it's, you know, the way he does it is absolutely brilliant. You know, it's definitely not an easy role to play.
I am going to go with Rami Malek for Mr. Robot. This is such a difficult position to be put in for a young actor with basically no experience. The guy from he is playing, as I listed, a drug addict with depression and anxiety disorder who is also delusional and who happens to be like a cyber genius trying to take down the biggest company in the world within like a secret organization. And as ridiculous as it sounds on paper, it is equally as flawless in execution. Like, Rami Malek is the main reason why. From the first second you start watching the pilot of Mr. Robot, like, that dude, his face, his eyes, his intensity is so captivating. Like, we talk about actors having, like, little neurotic tics. Like, that character is filled with them, and they are consistent. And when he is off his meds, he acts like somebody off his meds. When he is, having withdrawals from a drug addiction, he is acting like somebody having withdrawals. When he is being a paranoid delusional, he is acting like that. And we see the world from his point of view in large part in Mr. Robot. We do not see it from a third-person point of view like we do almost every other show on television. So we have to at once understand and empathize this incredibly complex, what should be divisive character. And Rami Malek's the intensity and the strength of his performance, the gravitas of his pronunciations, of his expressions, of his gestures and his movements are phenomenal. Not only I think he's the best actor on TV right now, I think his performance in season one of Mr. Robot might be the best performance by any actor in any season of television. And
you see, I've heard great things about not only the actor, not only the show, but that actor in particular. And I'm planning on watching it.
He's a really interesting looking dude too. Like, I think he's like part Iranian or something. Like, he just doesn't look like most people we see on television.
I think he played on like the last Twilight movie or something like that. That's why I had seen him in. Don't judge me for watching Twilight. But and he was, even like in the small role that he had in that, like, he was, you know, really great in it, considering, you know, the movie. But yeah.
Way to out yourself. Nobody here had to know you were a Twilight fan. But now
I didn't say I was a Twilight fan. I just said I've seen the movie. Okay, uh-huh. This is different.
Sure it is. All right, so next up, we're going to do best comedy. Okay, so the nominees are Catastrophe has a 100% critic approval score on Rotten Tomatoes. Critical consensus: Catastrophe proves that there's still a place for simple romantic comedy on television as long as the actors have chemistry and the jokes are laugh out loud funny. Andy Greenwald, formerly of Grantland, writes, "It is side-splittingly honest about love, anger, attraction, aging, pregnancy, and sex musk. It is also, not coincidentally, the finest and funniest new comedy of the year. To my knowledge, this is the first major award Catastrophe has been nominated for." You're welcome, Catastrophe. Playing House, Season 2. Rotten Tomatoes score 100%. To be fair, there were not enough critics to give a critical consensus for season 2, so we're using the season 1 critical consensus. Jessica St. Clair and Lennon Parham are a comedy duo worth watching, and their chemistry helps to make Playing House reasonably enjoyable and perceptive. Molly Eichel of the AV Club: "How comfortable Playing House feels, and comfortable is really the right word to describe the show, is due to the incredible chemistry between the creators and stars St. Clair and Parham, which cannot be overstated enough. In 2015, Playing House was nominated for a GLAAD Media Award for Outstanding Individual Episode in a Series Without a Regular LGBT Character for the episode Let's Have a Baby. Togetherness, Rotten Tomatoes score 93%. Togetherness is a delightful surprise that interweaves day-to-day life with moving, dramatic characters who have an affinity for depreciating, squirmy humor. David Weigand of the San Francisco Chronicle writes, "Togetherness is easy to like on one level, and probably a little more challenging as the Duplass brothers explore the quiet discontent among people who are just trying to do the best they can. It's worth the effort. The emotional payoff is enormous. For the Critics' Choice Television Awards, Melanie Lynskey was nominated for Best Supporting Actress, and Peter Gallagher was nominated for a Best Guest Performer in a Comedy Series. Veep, right? Season 4, Rotten Tomatoes score 100%. Veep shows no signs of slowing down in its fourth season, thanks to sharp, funny, rapid-fire dialogue between POTUS and her hilariously incompetent staff. Andy Greenwald, formerly of Grantland, writes, "There's simply nothing sharper or funnier on television, something that's particularly true this year, as Julia Louis-Dreyfus's grinning Selina Meyer has somehow stumbled her way into the Oval Office." After four consecutive nominations, in 2015, Veep won the Emmy for Best Comedy. It has won the same award from the Writers Guild of America. Finally, You're the Worst. Rotten Tomatoes score 96%. Expertly balancing character growth against edgy humor, Season 2 of You're the Worst elevates the show's excellent writing and talented cast to a new level. Greenwald writes, "You're the Worst isn't just drunker, sassier, and funnier than most sitcoms on the air. It takes decades of small-screen orthodoxy and slaps it gleefully upside its snooty, puritanical head." For the second consecutive year, You're the Worst is nominated for a Critics' Choice Award for Best Comedy. Ash, your winner is?
I'm going with Playing House. Part of the reason why is because I realized that I actually hadn't seen a lot of comedy shows this year. But, you know, Playing House, what I love about it, like you said, it's a comfortable show. Like, you could just watch it anytime. Like, you just sit down with whoever or by yourself to just watch it. And it really is a funny thing. This season, you know, season two, is these two characters are pretty much raising a baby together, two best friends. And after this baby's been born, you know, they're kind of trying to, like, find themselves. Like, one's trying to, you know, have a life outside of raising this child, you know, with a relationship and whatever, and trying, you know, with an ex and a new boyfriend. And the other one, who actually did, you know, have this baby, is trying to find herself as well as trying to find a life of, you know, what to do now. Like, she wants to think about going back to nursing instead of, you know, continuing being a waitress. She has to deal with her ex-husband, who is a complete fucking moron, you know. And it, all of it together, I find it just very... I mean, these two characters really do feel like best friends. That have been best, you know, two people who've been best friends since childhood. And they know each other so well. And they have these little, you know, inside jokes and just the way they could be, it's so in sync with each other, and yet they're completely different personalities. So I really enjoy this show.
I've mentioned it several times on here. I mentioned all of these except for Veep and Playing House, but You're the Worst for me is clearly the choice, because it's playing in areas that comedies aren't supposed to play in. The characters are the main characters are like a struggling writer who has an abusive family, a clinical depressive, a war vet with PTSD, and a woman child whose husband just left her. And these are the four like base characters of the show, and they play in both what real relationships are in 2015. It's very honest about that. It's very forthcoming about, this is the world we live in. And I think one thing that's really admirable about the show is sometimes the characters don't really want to be together. And it's not because they don't like each other or they don't love each other. Like, they're afraid that being around each other might make them hate themselves a little less. And it can go from, like, side-splittingly funny to, like, brutally honest and sharp, and even a little painful sometimes in a split second. And it's very, very impressive, and it's very different than almost anything else on television. I say almost anything else because togetherness is in the same vein. We didn't prepare for this. I didn't prepare for this. I just came up with it off the top of my head. So if you don't have an answer, that's good. Do you want it? Do you have an answer for best network comedy? Because I realize nothing we nominated is from a network.
Yeah, no. I don't know. Like I said, I realized I didn't watch a lot of comedy this year. You have shows like Nurse Jackie and, you know, different stuff. But, yeah, I don't know.
Okay, I just thought about it. I haven't given it a whole lot of contemplation, obviously. Like I said, I just thought of it. I'm going to go with The Grinder. Fred Savage and Rob Lowe play off of each other so well. It's paired with Grandfathered, which is also a pretty funny show.
Yeah.
We mentioned that before. But, like, whereas Grandfathered is, like, to me, just, like, chuckle sometimes. The Grinder is laugh-out-loud funny often. And it's all from the very earnest naivete of Rob Lowe, thinking that, like, the continued joke being that somehow he thinks because he played a lawyer, he is a lawyer.
Yeah.
And, like, it might, I don't know, it has really good critical reviews, but the ratings are not great. So I don't know what the issue is. I don't know if that's not connecting for other people, but it's definitely, I don't know if they just haven't done a good job marketing it. It's really working for me. Like, out of the network comedies I watch, it's my fave. All right, best drama. Dun, 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 dun. The Americans. Rotten Tomatoes score, 100%. Family-driven drama and psychological themes propel The Americans' tautly drawn tension, dispensing thrills of a different ilk this season. Andy Greenwald writes, The Americans remain the best show on TV about family, and you know, just the best show on TV, because it is both tender and unflinching in its examinations of lies big and small, good and bad. For three consecutive years, AFI has named it one of its top 10 TV programs of the year. In 2015, it won the Critics' Choice Award for Best Drama Series. It has also received a Peabody Award and an Outstanding Achievement in Drama Award from the Television Critics Association. Fargo, Rotten Tomatoes, 100%. Season 2 of Fargo retains all the elements that made the series an award-winning hit, successfully delivering another stellar saga powered by fascinating characters, cheeky cynicism, and just a touch of the absurd. Christopher Orr of The Atlantic writes, The cast is excellent, the plot lines are richer and more neatly interwoven, and the alternating portions of whimsy and menace are served up with extraordinary panache. Fargo just won the American Film Institute's Best Television Program of the Year Award. It is also currently nominated for a Golden Globe, a Satellite, and a Critics' Choice Award for Best Drama. It will most assuredly be nominated for an Emmy as well. Game of Thrones. Rotten Tomatoes, 98%. It's like one person was like, fuck Game of Thrones. Bloody action and extreme power plays return full throttle, as Game of Thrones enjoys a newfound liberation from the world of the source material, resulting in more unexpected thrills. Mary McNamara of the Los Angeles Times says, Breathtaking, heartbreaking, awe-inspiring, and addictive. It remains the single most remarkable feat of television possibly ever, increasingly admirable for its ability to grow rather than simply sustain. Game of Thrones is the reigning champion as the latest winner of an Emmy for Best Drama. This season was also nominated for Best Drama for a TCA Award, Satellite Award, Writers Guild of America Award, Golden Globe Award, and Producers Guild of America Award. The Leftovers. Rotten Tomatoes, 89%. The Leftovers continues to be unpredictable and provocative in Season 2, with its new location, though the inexplicable circumstances will still frustrate many viewers. Diane Gordon of The Wrap, though it's sobering to watch, it's also very moving and beautifully acted. The Leftovers should not be left behind. The Leftovers is currently nominated for Best Drama by the Critics' Choice Television Awards, and the episode International Assassin has been nominated for Best Episode of Drama by the Writers Guild Association. Mr. Robot, Rotten Tomatoes, 98%. Mr. Robot is a suspenseful cyber thriller with timely stories and an intriguing, provocative premise. Keith Ulick of The Hollywood Reporter. The series is ridiculous in description and enthralling in execution. Because of Malick's natural charisma and his way with creator and head writer Sam Ismail's frequent gerrymanders against the powerful and moneyed. Mr. Robot is currently nominated for a Golden Globe, a Satellite Award, a Writers Guild Award, and a Critics' Choice Award for Best Drama. It will also inevitably be nominated for an Emmy. Ash, what is your best drama of 2015?
Best drama of 2015, I'm going with Fargo.
Okay, and we did just talk about it, but that was a different pod, technically, so tell us why.
I just loved Fargo. Like, the way, each scene was a scene for me to just tune in and just watch it. Like, each scene was so very important to the story of this show, and it didn't waste time. It was cinematically, done beautifully. It was, it felt with the time period that it was supposed to be taking place, and everything just completely intertwined with each other, and it all made sense. Well, besides the UFO. Well, we could actually ignore that. But, like I said, every episode was great. Every scene was done amazingly. The actors were amazing that was chosen for these specific roles. And like I said, there was like no time wasted on this show. It felt very clean. It felt very, tight. And it was just really amazing. The storytelling was amazing. Everything was just amazing about it.
It was. My answer's Mr. Robot. And I agree with everything you said. As television series have traditionally been executed, Fargo is executed as well as one can be. I would say just about the same thing about The Americans this year. But here's the thing. I don't want to say that they're playing checkers and Sam Ishmael's playing chess with Mr. Robot. That's not accurate. These guys are playing chess. They're doing something really difficult. And not only is Noah Hawley playing chess with Fargo, he's a fucking chess master. He's goddamn Bobby Fischer over here. He's great at what he does. Best in the world, probably. But that's something completely different from what Rami Malek's doing. They're playing chess, and he's building an H-bomb. So it's not checkers to chess. It's like Bobby Fischer to Jay Oppenheimer. Like, what he's doing is something that's never been seen on television before because it is just so fucking different. We are in a subjective, first-person point of view where we do not know the answers. We do not know what is real. We do not know anything. We have an entire episode pass that is a fever pitch hallucination. The audience is aware for several episodes, or should be aware if you can put two and two together, for several episodes that one character is not real, and that is a completely valid within the show's logic because we understand that our main character is delusional and he has some childhood issues. Like, the things this show is doing, I didn't think were capable on television. It changes genre from episode to episode. One episode is a mystery thriller. One episode is a spy drama. One episode is an absurdist comedy. One episode is a cyber hacker thriller. Like, each episode is something entirely different. And each time you think, they're doing something fucking crazy. It's going to fall off the rails. They can't keep doing this. And they just keep doing it. And they just keep doing it. And while you were paying attention to all the crazy, and while you were paying attention to all the amazing but bizarre things that they're doing with this sort of Fight Club storyline where they are where Rami Malek's character is involved in a secret organization trying to take down world banks. While they're involved with all of this, they have Trojan horsed a really personal, intimate family drama into it. And that is the ultimate hook. Because while they are doing all these things that have never been done on TV before and that are really bizarre and wild and you can't believe that you're seeing it, like, I wasn't even sure movies could do this. This is crazy. This is Fight Club, but better. And then you realize that while that was happening, they were also building in the heart of any good television show, which is these deep, personal, intimate connections between the characters. And I just don't know that it's... I won't say it can't be done better. I'm just going to say it's never been done before. Mr. Robot, best season... I hate to call it television. It's the best season of television ever. It's not television, though. It's a new art form they've made over there on, like, stodgy old USA with Burn Notice and all that other shit. No disrespect to Playing House. But, like, in the middle of Raw and Burn Notice, we get Mr. Robot, which was in itself, like, the biggest surprise of 2015. So, we are done with some of our awards. We're going to give out a best scene and a best episode for each of us personally. But I'm going to get into some detail describing the scene or the episode. So, if you do not want a spoiler, tune out. Thank you for listening. We will be back. I think we'll be back after New Year's. Right, Ash?
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll find something to talk about. But, for now, we're going to talk about, you know, if scene or episode first.
Probably, I don't know, you pick.
All right, well, I got, I think I have, I say do scene and then go episode.
Okay.
All right, so Fargo, in the episode Rhinoceros, Carl's stand against Dutch. When Ed demands a lawyer, Lou summons a drunken Carl Weathers, the only attorney in town, to the station. As Carl is leaving the station, Bear Gerhardt and his men arrive for his son, Charlie. Knowing Ed would be shot on sight, Lou hatches a plan. Carl has to mediate with Bear, claiming that he is Charlie's lawyer, and that Charlie, still a minor, will soon be released, which Carl has to convince Bear is a better option than the Gerhardt's plan for bloodshed. Game of Thrones, Hardhome. Wildlings and Jon Snow versus the White Walkers. While Jon Snow is loading the ships with wildlings, Hardhome is attacked by an army of whites. Hundreds of wildlings attempt to flee, forcing their way onto the boats and attacking each other. Jon and the Night Watch brothers assist in the defense of Hardhome, helping defend the walls from white attacks. Jon and Tormund see several White Walkers observing the battle, and Jon moves to recover the bag of dragonglass weapons. Entering a large hut, Jon and Lyanna are attacked by a White Walker, who easily kills Lyanna before moving on to Jon. Jon is attacked before he can recover the dragonglass and manages to escape the hut. The White Walker pursues him and they fight, but the Walker is momentarily stunned when he is unable to break Jon's Valyrian steel sword Longclaw, and Jon manages to kill him. His victory is short-lived as the walls surrounding Hardhome fall to the whites, and Jon and his remaining allies are forced to flee. As they return to the boats, Jon witnesses the Night's King reviving the dead, including Carsey and many of the wildlings, and the Night's Watch as whites. The Leftovers. Lens. Erica versus Nora. Nora knocks on the Murphy's door, feigning concern. She wants to give Erica the DSD questionnaire, but she obviously has ulterior motives. You're scared that if you answer these questions, everyone's going to know that your daughter didn't depart, Nora says, getting her in the front door. They sit, and Nora asks the questions. And Erica's answers are confessional. She was going to leave John before Evie went missing. She had withdrawn money from the bank, hence that bag of cash hidden with her hearing aid batteries, and was planning to split town. But she was worried about her children, especially Evie. So she used her grandmother's old ritual about the buried bird to make a wish that Evie would understand what was to come. I wish that she'd be okay without me, she says. The next night, my daughter was gone. Terrible things happen in this world, and the only comfort we get is that we didn't cause them, Nora maintains, though she's trying to convince herself more than Erica. So I'm sorry, but Erica, this had nothing to do with you. Erica gives Nora the death stare and chases her out of the house with a reciprocal question about her own departed children. Mr. Robot, episode 1.5, bravetraveler.asf. Discovering Shayla's body in the trunk. Elliot's lover, Shayla, has been kidnapped by the sociopath Vera. Vera threatens her life unless Elliot can break him out of jail. Elliot successfully breaks Vera out of jail, and Vera immediately kills his brother. Upon Elliot's query about Shayla, Vera tosses him the keys to the car he has been forced to drive and says she has been with you the whole time. In the background of a jailbreak, Elliot opens the trunk and finds Shayla inside with her throat slit. The Walking Dead, Rick Grimes breakdown. Rick believes exiling Pete will only put Alexandria in danger, but Deanna refuses to listen. Rick talks to Jesse again and reveals that he knows Pete is abusing her. Jesse reassures Rick she can fix her relationship with Pete, but Rick is not convinced. He promises to protect Jesse, and she agrees to let him protect her just as Pete returns home. Jesse stands up for herself and orders Pete to leave, but Pete grows angry and the two men begin to fight. Their fight makes it to the street, and the entire town watches. Jesse and Carl attempt to stop the fight, but fail. Rick finally subdues Pete in a headlock. Deanna orders Rick to stand down, but Rick doesn't acknowledge, instead warning Pete that if he harms either Jesse or Sam again, he will kill him. Deanna once again orders Rick to withdraw, but Rick points his revolver at the crowd and goes on a rant, telling Deanna how Alexandria is too complacent and will eventually destroy itself under her leadership, and that the way to survive is to have people like Pete executed. Michonne eventually silences him mid-rant by knocking him unconscious. I did not see that Walking Dead scene. Is that pretty accurate, Ash?
Yeah, it's pretty accurate.
Okay.
I think you'll clip later.
Okay. All right, so your winner, best scene of the year.
My best scene would be Erica versus Nora in the Leftovers episode Lens.
And what did you love so much about Erica versus Nora?
What I love so much about that that scene is that, for one, there was no violence in it. And it was, it was a scene between these two characters.
It was emotional violence.
Yeah. It was no physical violence, but it was very an emotional, psychological, intense scene. And all it was, on the surface, it was a conversation. You know, one asking another person questions to give some, reassurance. But the way the scene goes, it flips the script on the other character, and it's like a psychological battle between these two characters in a simple setting. It's just in the character's living room, and it's a conversation, and you can feel the intensity and the stressfulness of what's happening, and the characters, you expect one character to break down, but it flips it to, the other one ends up running away when that character was the one that brought, this conversation about in the first place. So, what I love about it, the way it was filmed, the way it was portrayed by these two actresses, these amazing actresses, and these two characters, and I just absolutely love it. And it was an already, amazing episode. This scene was just brilliant.
Yeah, I had a hard time disputing anything you said. What I love most about TV and film in general is the visual storytelling. The thing that film or television can do that a book cannot is just let you experience something without words. Just process what you're seeing. That big, long scene from Hardhome in Game of Thrones I described, I don't think there was a word of dialogue. It went on for 20 minutes, and I was fucking captivated. Like, I've never experienced, 20 minutes without dialogue where I was just, on the edge of my seat the entire time. And it was just visually stunning. The giant, I don't know if you remember, walking through,
yeah.
Stomping on the whites, and the White King, and the revival, and everything about that scene was beautiful and stunning, and It was gripping entertainment. And, like, we have essentially been waiting for 5 seasons for for combat between these whites who are coming. Winter is coming. And the people of the Seven Kingdoms. So, like, seeing the Night's Watch and the Wildlings battle this force that has been coming for so long, and seeing two things we learn is that Valyrian is going to be useful, and that most of, like, humanity is fucked. Like, seeing it so visually spelled out for us in such a beautiful landscape. That's my scene of the year. It was just, I can't remember a prettier, more captivating visual sequence in television. And we have one more award. Ultimately, you could argue this is the most important award, because television by nature is episodic. We have episode by episode by episode. They have a beginning, a middle, and an end. So, best episode, one could argue, is even more important than best show. I'm not sure I would argue it, but it's possible. So, our nominees. And Ash, I think I know what you're going to pick, because I'm not sure what else you have here. The Americans. Do male robots dream of electric sheep? Martha informs Philip that the FBI's male robot has been sent for repairs after a tense Agent God kicked and broke it. Philip and Elizabeth go to the repair facility to install a recording device inside male robot and are discovered there by Betty, an old woman who had come into work on the business's books in the middle of the night. Betty tells Elizabeth the details of her life and her family. Moved by Betty's openness, Elizabeth reveals her identity as a Russian spy before allowing Betty, who knows now that she will be killed, to overdose on her own heart medication. Hannibal, The Wrath of the Lamb. While brainstorming ideas for how to catch the serial killer Dollarhide, Graham suggests using Lecter as bait by staging his escape from the hospital. Lecter agrees to this plan, but only after Graham personally requests his participation. Crawford and Bloom plot to kill both Lecter and Dollarhide once the bait is accepted. In a session with his psychiatrist, Graham reveals his intentions of Lecter not being recaptured, leaving unstated whether that means his death or his freedom. As the plan is implemented, Lecter's convoy is unexpectedly ambushed by Dollarhide, who kills all the guards while sparing Graham and Lecter and allowing them to flee. They travel to the cliffside house where Lecter had previously kept Abigail Hobbs and Miriam Lass as captives. There, Dollarhide, having pursued them, attacks again, shooting Lecter in the stomach and stabbing Graham in the face, intending to kill both on film. Graham and Lecter, working together, overpower Dollarhide and kill him. Both soaked in blood, Graham embraces Lecter and then pulls them both over the cliff to ambiguous fates. The Leftovers, International Assassin. Kevin is plunged into the realm of the undead, a hotel full of people stuck between life and death. In this world, Kevin is an international assassin, charged with assassinating presidential nominee Patty Levin. Meanwhile, Kevin saves a little girl from drowning in the pool. Then, he's tortured by Levin's security team, led by Gladys, in order to confirm intention and identity. He passes after admitting some truths and attends a meeting with Patty. Just as he's about to kill her, the woman claims that she's a decoy, that the real Levin had paid her off. Kevin shoots her anyway, but the fact turned out to be true. He realizes that the little girl from the pool was really Levin. Having received instructions from his father, Kevin takes Patty to a water well back in Jordan and begrudgingly tosses her down. An aged and battered Patty calls out from the depths of the well. Kevin climbs and falls down. Patty bears her sorrow, and then Kevin drowns her. As he does, he is returned to the edge of the Wood of Jordan, where Michael is waiting. Mad Men, Time and Life. What at first appears to be a failure to pay the lease on time leads to SCP's discovering the McCanns plan to close down their office and move everyone into the parent company's headquarters. Don devises a plan to move to California as Sterling Cooper West, and manages the lucrative contracts that conflict with McCann's portfolio. Eventually, McCann's CEO lets Don, Roger, Joel, and Pete and Ted know that the absorption into McCann is going to happen anyway, and they should appreciate their, air quotes, victory. As rumors fly, Don's secretary pressures him to make an announcement. The partners call the rest of the staff into the lounge and announce the coming move. Though Roger and Don try to spin the news positively, the partners quickly lose the crowd's attention and employees wander away in disappointment. Mr. Robot, episode 1.7, White Rose, .m4v. Darlene steals a gun and has a conversation with Angela that implies they are longtime friends. Elliot and F Society replan their attack but still need the Dark Army. Elliot meets White Rose, a trans woman obsessed with time, who says the Dark Army is backed out because Gideon, suspicious of Elliot's story, turned E-Corp's hacked server into a honeypot. With help from Darlene, Elliot successfully shuts this down. Then, Elliot tells Darlene of their planned success, and an ecstatic Darlene tells him she loves him. He kisses Darlene, who is revolted. She asks if he had forgotten again. Elliot realizes that Darlene is his sister, but he has no recollection of her. He finds a CD that contains old family photos, revealing that Mr. Robot is his father. Best episode of the year, Ash.
Well, consider I
saw one of them.
The episode I'll pick is International Assassin.
Okay, first of all, I just want to say that's on you because you did not submit any episodes of for consideration.
Yeah, I didn't. I'm sure like probably seen, you know, a lot of these. In different categories as well. I probably would end up changing my mind on some of these, but. For this, I will go with International Assassin. But this episode was, to me, very well done, and it was so good. Like, the leftovers this season in general was really good.
Let me just ask you this question, then, and you can go from there. Was International Assassin your favorite episode of The Leftovers?
My favorite episode? I could consider probably like the top two.
Okay.
But it was a great episode. Because it was different. It felt so out of place, and yet it still worked. This is, you know, the show is in a world where, you know, there's a lot of question marks, you know, go all up in the show. But it's still absolutely intriguing because it's about, you know, the people and, you know, the thing about International Assassin, it was the episode about Kevin. Even though Kevin is the main character of the show, he doesn't, you know, necessarily do much. And this was the episode about him and what, you know, him trying to, you know, escape his demons in a very interesting way by dying, you know, trying to get so he can get rid of...
In a very interesting way.
Yeah, he had to die. And, you know, to, you know, kill... You know, he had to kill this woman who's already dead, but is still haunting him. So he, you know, he dies and goes to, you know, this other world where he dresses up as an assassin and has to eliminate Patty, who was a great character, by the way.
Yeah, I mean, this is... This episode is also a lot about Patty. It was really one of her best episodes.
Yes, not just about Ken, it's about Patty, you know, Patty as well. And, you know, it showed that Kevin, you know, trying to, in a way, try to go the easy way out, in a sense. Like, he figured, like, okay, we found out, you know, the episode before that he did try to commit, he really was trying to commit suicide. And he tried to, you know, he doesn't listen much. So when Patty tells him that I'm just a decoy, he kills her anyways, expecting that everything's going to be okay. Not realizing that, no, you have to pay attention and listen. And I loved everything about it, the way it was filmed. It was very confusing, and yet it wasn't too confusing. It was a build-up to the end of that episode, and I thought it was, you know, the way it was filmed, having the Godfather theme music playing in the background, everybody kid was brilliant, and I loved it. Like I said, I